So we've been talking about Israel and the nations, but for the purpose of my talk today, I think the whole focus of the understanding what the ten toes are about is to understand Daniel's image of chapter 2. And I think it's all about Israel under foreign rule. So could I get someone to read this out, someone who can see that clearly? Or do you want me to read it?
I'll read it.
Okay.
You are that head of gold. After you, another kingdom will arise inferior to yours. Next, a third kingdom, one of bronze, will rule over the whole earth. Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others. Just as you saw that the feet and toes were partly of baked clay and partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom. Yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, even as you saw iron mixed with clay. As the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end. But it will itself endure forever.
So are you two visitors, ladies, familiar with this history? So this is all going to be, because we've been talking about this dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, a dream of an image which was actually prophetic of how the foreign nations were going to rule over Israel. So it's kind of pretty complicated, heavy stuff. So I hope
I might go to sleep.
Anyway, hope you can pick up something from it. So there's this dream of the image. So as I've been looking at this, I realised something. So Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, was the head of gold on this image. And we're told that after you, another kingdom will arise inferior to yours. And that was the Medes and Persians who came after the Babylonians. But does that strike a chord with anyone? Like, there's something wrong about this?
Were they inferior?
They were not inferior. No.
And as everybody says now, become a personal remark.
Okay. It's not the law of the Medes and Persians, June.
Well,
isn't it?
But we even know from the Bible how great the kingdom of Persia was. We read in Esther 1:1, this is what happened during the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled over 120 provinces stretching from India to Kush or Ethiopia. This is like the Bible makes a point of the greatness of the Persians. So why does Daniel call it inferior? And we read in Wiki, the Persian Empire, which dominated most of the Middle East, ruled over a greater percentage of the world's population than any other empire in history. It still holds that record. A higher percent of the world population than any other empire. You can actually look at a list of the greatest empires in Wiki, and I think it comes in at like number 12 or something. I think it ranks the British Empire the greatest, but that was purely because it came later and it ruled over more people. But Persia ruled over more percentage of the world population, and it's never been beaten. So why does it say it was inferior in our image? Okay, well, let's look at these kingdoms. So this brown area here was the Babylonian kingdom. You can see it only occupied that area, and it only lasted for a short time, the Neo-Babylonian. Like, we're told in the Bible it was for 70 years. Wiki gives it a few more years, 83 years or something. But the Persian Empire, actually at the time of the Babylonian Empire, the kingdom of Egypt here was just as great. The kingdom of Lydia was ranked greater than the kingdom of Babylon. It was fabulously wealthy under that Croesus, whatever his name was, really wealthy, wealthier than Babylon. Although Babylon did have the greatest city, the actual city of Babylon itself was the biggest city in the world. But the empire itself wasn't. And then contemporary, these are all contemporary. So contemporary to Babylon, we had the Medes. They had this massive control here. The Persians only had a smaller bit. But then the Persians rose up and they swallowed this whole lot. They took over Lydia and the Medes. Well, they combined and Babylon and Egypt. And that's what the three ribs in the mouth of the bear, I think that's what they equate to, the other empires that Persia swallowed. Okay, so still our puzzle, why are they called inferior? Okay, because it's a really bad translation. I've found this quite a lot when you look at words. Notice the word for inferior here is, it's got H772. So the same word here, in the same verse even, is translated as the earth. So this, so it's an Aramaic word actually, mainly used in Daniel. And it's used 21 times in the Bible. 20 times it's translated as earth. One time the translators decided to call it inferior. And so it should really be earth. It makes much more sense. So what it's saying, after you will arise another kingdom out of the earth. Because that's what this image is about. It's talking about the kingdoms of the earth, the beasts that rule over Israel. And that word, like, translators really influence how we read things. They can choose what English word they put, like this word, to you can mean out of, like out of the earth. So, So that's gotten rid of that problem, to my satisfaction. So when history doesn't, like, gel with what the Bible's saying, sometimes you've got to dig a bit deeper, I think. So Israel were under this curse. This is what the image is all about, foreign rule over Israel for disobeying God. Could I get someone else? Maybe you, Ro, could you read that? Or is
okay.
It too?
Yep. So this is the curse from Deuteronomy 28. If you do not obey the Lord your God and do not carefully follow all his commands and decrees I'm giving you today, all these curses will come on you. The Lord will strike you with wasting disease, with fever and inflammation, with scorching heat and drought, with blight and mildew, which will plague you until you perish. The sky over your head will be bronze, and the ground beneath you iron. The Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You'll come at them from one direction, but flee from them in seven, and you'll become a thing of horror to all the kingdoms of the earth. Your carcasses will be food for all the birds and the wild animals, and there'll be no one to frighten them away. The Lord will bring a nation against you from far away, from the ends of the earth, like an eagle swooping down. The Lord will send you back in ships to Egypt on a journey I said you should never make again. There you will offer yourselves for sale for your enemies, as male and female slaves. But no one will buy you.
Wow. Okay, so there's a few little interesting points here. Notice the mention of wild animals. Your carcasses will be food for all the birds and wild animals. Well, this is symbolic. Like, this means the wild animals are the nations who pop up later in Daniel 7, which are the wild animals who rule over them. And notice the mention of bronze and iron here. The sky over your head will be bronze and the earth, ground beneath you, iron. These are things that pop up in the beasts and animals too. Beasts with bronze claws and iron teeth. And yeah, so it's all picking up this symbology. And another interesting point, we're told, like this is at the end of the cursing, God's going to send you back in ships to Egypt. So when did the Jews go back to Egypt in ships? No ideas?
Jeremiah.
No. I guess we tend to think that when the Jews were scattered in AD 70, that was kind of the main big thing and the end of them. But it wasn't. There were actually a lot still around after that. So let's just read. Who's heard of the Bar Kokhba revolt? It occurred in between 132 and 136 after Christ, and it's called the Third Jewish War. So the destruction of the temple in AD 70 was the first Jewish war. Then there was another uprising of Jews in about 117, I think it was. That was the second Jewish war. And this was the third and final Jewish war, and it was led by some guy called Kokhba. And this is sort of a summary of how it ended. In 135 CE, Hadrian's army besieged Bethar, and on the 9th of Av, the Jewish fast day commemorating the destruction of the first and second holy temples, the walls of Bethar fell. After a fierce battle, every Jew in Bethar was killed. The Romans ploughed Jerusalem with a yoke of oxen. So again, Jerusalem is getting trodden underfoot. Jews were sold into slavery and many were transported to Egypt. And I've read in other places, by ship. Jerusalem was turned into a pagan city called Aula Capitolonia. And the Jews were forbidden to live there. So they're like, no Jews allowed. Hadrian actually changed the country's name from Judea to Syria Palestina. So this is like the fulfillment of that prophecy in Deuteronomy 28. This is when the Jews go back to Egypt as slaves. It's like the end of their time in, as you know, ruling in Israel or being prominent there. They were really scattered from this point on, 136 CE. So in AD 70, they estimate there are about 30,000 Jews killed, and Josephus describes that really graphically. But this battle, 580,000 Jews estimate killed, 50 fortified towns and 985 villages razed to the ground, many more Jews dying of famine and disease. This is according to Wiki. So this is like much bigger than AD 70. This is like, it was in some places they referred to it as the annihilation of the Jews.
When was this?
Bar Kokhba Rebellion, 132 to 136 after Christ.
So was this a war because the Jews rose up?
Yes.
And then the Romans?
Yeah, the Romans were sick of these Jews rising up. So this was the time of peace, the Pax Romana. The Jews were the blot on their, you know, they were only a little thing compared to the Roman Empire, so it didn't make any difference to what was considered a peaceful time. To the Jews it made a difference, but not to anyone else really. And so then we read about what Hadrian did. Hadrian was the emperor of the time. Hadrian prohibited the Torah law and the Hebrew calendar and executed Judaic scholars. The sacred scroll was ceremonially burned on the Temple Mount. At the former temple sanctuary, he installed two statues, one of Jupiter, another of himself. In an attempt to erase any memory of Judea or ancient Israel, he wiped the name off the map and replaced it with Syria Palestina. By destroying the association of Jews to Judea and forbidding the practice of Jewish faith, Hadrian aimed to root out a nation that inflicted heavy casualties on the Roman Empire. Unlike the aftermath of the first Jewish-Roman War, AD 70, the majority of the Jewish population of Judea was either killed, exiled, or sold into slavery after this revolt. And Jewish religious and political authority was suppressed far more brutally. After the revolt, the Jewish religious center shifted to the Babylonian Jewish community. Actually, I just listened to some Christadelphian from England give a talk saying there was no Babylon at this stage, it was all destroyed. That's really, you know, because they try to say that Babylon is really code for Rome, but that's nonsense. Babylon, it went on for many hundreds of years, and this is where the Jewish community shifted to. And that's where the Babylonian Talmud was written between 300 and 500 AD. And so when Peter says, "She who is in Babylon sends you greetings," it makes perfect sense, because that's where they went when, you know, there always was a huge Jewish community there that stayed on. It didn't fizzle out till about 1500 or somewhere around there, I think. And it fizzled out slowly. What's called the Jerusalem Talmud was actually compiled in Galilee because they weren't allowed in Jerusalem, but it was still called the Jerusalem Talmud. I mention all this because it brings us to the gap in this image that we're talking about. You've got your continuous historic theory that the time of the Romans continues down through history to the present day. I'm looking at it from another angle. I don't believe that's right. I believe there's a gap. And I was thinking about this theory, there has to be a gap. There's a gap in so many prophecies. It just jumps from then, bang, we're at the time of the end. So I was Googling, you know, gap image or something. And what pops up? Harry Whittaker has already thought of this, and Duncan Heaster's already thought of this. So Harry Whittaker said, "The book of Daniel contains five separate visions. These are found to have several characteristics in common. They all give a continuous historical fulfillment. They all find their climax in the appearance of Messiah. They all include a long gap." So this is my little image, and had I redrawn him now, I would have done him more to scale, more like this sort of thing. So I've put the a gap where the in 136 BC, where the Jews, this is like their end, they're out of their land, they're scattered. So this prophecy is only relevant to when the Jews are in their land ruled over by foreigners. Okay. And then down the bottom here we've got the ten toes, which is the days we're in, the days of the ten-toe kings, because it's in the time of those kings the God of heaven sets up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. So we jump from there to the toes with the gap. So something's got to happen. So to help us understand the toes, Daniel's given us something else. He's given us the beasts. So the beasts of Daniel 7, I think everyone knows they correspond to the same nations that make up the image. So the ten toes correspond to the ten horns of the beast. Ah, okay. This is a bit out of sync here. Uh, Okay, so this is, I was just showing here other places where the prophecies just have a big gap and just jump from early to the end. So we've got our seven, Daniel's 70 week prophecy, you know, 77s, you know, 70 weeks of years are for your people. And the middle of the last seven, the Messiah's cut off. And that's like nearly the end of that whole prophecy. And then at the end, excuse me, then at the end, you've got the kingdom set up and the return of Jesus. You've got a definite gap in that prophecy. And between Daniel 11 and 12, you've got the Seleucids and Ptolemies, king of north and south, racing up and down Egypt and Rome. And then, bang, you've got Daniel 12, which is you're at the resurrection. There's a gap. It's all the continuous thing. Then you've got Revelation 17. You've got five fallen kings. One is, and one is yet to be. So at the time that was written, the one is has to be Rome, and you've got your five fallen kings prior to Rome, and the one yet to be is the one after the gap, the final power, the ten horns and toes that again put Israel under foreign control, which hasn't happened yet. That's what we're waiting for. So you've got these consistent gaps. And of course, for the Romans to continue on, and you had many other empires rule over Israel after the Romans. You know, you had the Byzantine, the Sassanid, the Arab, the Turkish, the Saladin's empire, which was massive, and the Ottoman Empire. They're not in the image. Why? Because it's only relevant to the Jews in their land. So if we... if we want to be consistent, I mean, like, this would have to have ridiculously long legs. What I'm trying to show here, this image was in proportion. It had, I was thinking about this too, the proportion of the image. Like, if you do art, like, you start with your head. If you know the size of the head, you can work out for an adult the rest of the body. It's generally 7.5 heads. But in art, to make it look grander, they allow 8 heads. So more impressive. Actually, my calculations, I think this image actually is 9.5 heads. Of that, anyway. More about that later. So, yeah, Harry and his here, Jews, Arabs and Bible prophecy. He's also got a chap a bit in proportion, and he's drawn this. So he said, we know the head was 70 years for Babylon. So roughly the Persians, Greeks and Romans had 200 years each, which really works out nicely proportioned. And the feet are really very short. It says they only have 1 hour with the beast. So Harry says, of course the Roman Empire lasted for about 800 years actually, which would seem to require legs twice as long as the body. But the 200 years given here is that period during which the Romans dominated the Jews in their own land. Prophetically, the rest is of no consequence. So Harry is saying too that when they're out of the land, this, it's not what the prophecy's about anymore. And so here's our image. We've looked at all these empires, but there's something odd about this image. Like I said before, if you compare history to what God's giving us, they have to gel. So there's another odd thing about this image. Can anyone spot it? It's actually one of the talks we did, the Maccabees. The Maccabees had complete rule. The Romans didn't come straight after the Greeks. The Maccabees did, the Hasmonean Empire. So the Babylonian Empire lasted 70 years. And I believe the Hasmonean Empire, there's a lot of variation in this, when they actually have had autonomous control. but I'm going with what they themselves say in the books of Maccabees, and I believe it was from 142 to 63 BC when Pompey came and made them a quiet state of Rome. yes, I forgot to click that. Oh well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the Hasmonean kingdom should be here. There should be another gap in it actually lasted longer than Babylon did. They were fully independent for 79 years. And so that's the area the Hasmonean kingdom occupied, which is, you know, quite impressive, I think. So I'm going to go back to the beasts now. So we compare the beasts to the to our image. So we're going to read about the beasts. Do I have another reader volunteer? Thanks, Val.
Daniel 7, four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground, so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth, between its teeth. It was told, "Get up and eat your fill of flesh." After that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and on its back it had 4 wings like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening, and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns.
Okay.
Well, it's still going.
Yeah.
While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them. And 3 of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being, and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat.
Thanks, Val. So here again, we've got these beasts, and we know they're those empires, and they seem to jump straight to the end when the Ancient of Days, which is God, takes his seat for judgment. So we need to know a bit about these beasts. It's interesting, we're told they came up out of the sea at this point. But in verse 16 it says, talking about exactly the same thing, he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. The 4 great beasts are 4 kings that will rise from the earth. So when we get to Revelation, there's beasts coming out of the earth and beasts coming out of the sea, and you think, oh, they must be different beasts. But this is saying, this beast, or beasts, it says they come out of the sea, they come out of the earth. It's the same thing. It's the same beast. So don't get too distressed in Revelation trying to identify different beasts because they're coming from different places, when, you know, the sea and the earth are the same thing here, and they're the same beasts. But these beasts actually weren't the first beasts God talks about to come against Israel. I'm going to talk about a couple of other beasts because we need to know about them to make up our conglomerate beast of Revelation. Babylon was not the first. Assyria was before Babylon, and Jeremiah 50 says, Israel is a hunted sheep driven away by lions. First, the king of Assyria devoured him, and now at last Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, has gnawed his bones. So, the beasts kind of morph. Assyria and Babylon are both described as a lion. So in Revelation, when we've got a beast that speaks like a lion, you know, it's got the characteristics of Assyria and Babylon because they're both lions. And actually, the 70 years for Babylon, it began when Babylon captured Assyria, not actually Israel. So it's actually legitimate to include both Assyria and Egypt in that 70-year period, because Egypt also controlled Israel for 3 or 4 years. When, remember, they made Israel a client state to Egypt after Josiah died, before Babylon took over. Anyway, after Babylon, after Assyria, we're going to look at Babylon, the beast of this image. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human, and the mind of a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. So this, of course, is talking about Nebuchadnezzar. And what I found really interesting is, on the gate of his city of Babylon, the Ishtar Gate, remember that beautiful blue Ishtar Gate? Mm-hmm. King Nebuchadnezzar himself actually put these lions. And if you look closely, they're winged lions. See, that's a wing? Yeah. So I find that really interesting, that he actually put images of winged lions on his gate, and God describes him as a winged lion. So there's a lot of symbology there. And they worshipped, you know, they worshipped gods, lions as gods. And I think the wings were a symbol of protection. And next, of course, after that, there were the Medes and Persians, described as the bear, which Val read. And after that, the Greeks with the four wings and the four heads. And I believe, well, we know the Greek Empire was split into four. And it's, I actually found an Egyptian picture of a leopard with four heads and two wings, and it said it was a symbol of ruling the four corners of the earth. And we're told that the Greek kingdom would fill the whole earth. So I think there's a connection there too. And the fourth beast, different from the others, was the Romans. And it will devour the whole earth, tread it down and crush it. It was diverse. Well, that word diverse is normally translated as changed, out of all the kingdoms, and it had 10 horns. And I think I mentioned this in my last talk here, that the Romans were the worst because they were the ones that scattered the Jews. This is all about the trampling under feet. And this is what the 10 horns are going to do at the time of Israel's final punishment. They're also going to trample the Jews underfoot. And that's why I think the 10 horns come out of the Roman Empire, because they follow on that same pattern. Okay, so here's our image with all those beasts. And the final beast, it jumps to the end times. So we're told a bit about it in Daniel, but it morphs into Revelation. And Revelation gives us, I believe, it's the same beast with more detail. And we learn in Revelation a few more things. It's got 7 heads. And a harlot sitting on its back. So the formula for understanding the beast with seven heads and ten horns, the beasts are the earthly empires in control of the promised land while the Jews are in it. The ten horns, I hope to show you, are the Arabs. And the beast with seven heads and ten horns equals Israel in the land surrounded by the Arab enemies. I saw a beast, this is Revelation now, I saw a beast come out of the sea. It had ten horns and seven heads, with ten crowns on its horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like a bear and a mouth like a lion. So we're picking up that imagery of the other beasts, like this is why I call it a conglomerate beast. And we're told in Revelation 17 that we're told what the seven heads are. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated, but they're two kings. They're that, and they're also seven kings or kingdoms. And I've mentioned this before, I'll just mention it quickly. I believe that the seven mountains are the location which never changes. Israel were told to go into the land of seven nations and conquer it. A mountain is a symbol of a nation in the Bible. So, and if you count the nations they were told to go in and drive out, there's seven in Joshua, and we're told there were seven in Acts. As well as that, they're the place and the inhabitants of the place. And it gives us this other riddle. Five have fallen, one is, the other's not yet come. But when he does come, he will remain for a little while. The beast who once was and now is not is an eighth king. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. So this is what I believe they are. These, from 609 onwards, from the time of our image, we're told that Assyria was devouring Israel, but then Babylon came after them, and we know that Egypt came. I didn't have time to find all the quotes about Egypt, but...
You lazy girl.
Egypt came, and after Josiah died, carried one of the kings off to Egypt, and they were a client state. And then we had Babylon, the Medo-Persian script. So they are the five fallen kings from 609. One is the Romans, and one is to be is the final power that overthrows Israel. And if you're trying to do this whole fill in the gap between the Romans and now, it doesn't make sense that there are five fallen kings at the time this was written, and one who is. So there has to be a gap. And it makes up this conglomerate beast. So I believe the beast on the harlot on the back of the beast is Israel, because, as Harry says, we have to interpret the Bible from the scripture itself. And the Old Testament tells us over and over and over, Israel is the harlot. They were meant to be the true light of the world, but... Ezekiel 16, confront Jerusalem with her detestable practices and say, your ancestry and birth were in the land of the Canaanites, your father was an Amorite, your mother a Hittite, you became very beautiful and rose to be a queen, and your fame spread among the nations, you increased your promiscuity to include Babylonia, a land of merchants. This is picking up Revelation 18 language here. And even with this, you are not satisfied. I'm filled with fury against you, acting like a brazen harlot. I could, do pages and pages of Israel the harlot, but there's not time. So, but people will say, but Israel never ruled over the other kings of the earth, as Revelation 17:18 says. So that also is a bad translation. The woman that you saw is the great city which has dominion over the kings of the earth. That's what it says. It should read, the woman you saw is the great city having kingship among the kings of the earth. So it really means that she has given up her role as God's light of the world, and she gets mixed up and has kingship amongst all the other nations. She just becomes like one of them. She sits on many waters, meaning she trades with many nations. So she left God and she, you know, became a corrupt harlot. And we have to, as we count the number of seven hills and nations, so we count the number of ten. In Psalm 83, we've got ten nations who hate Israel and want to wipe her out, and the language really corresponds with what's written in Revelation. Come, they say, let us destroy them as a nation so that the name of Israel is remembered no more. With one mind they plot together. They form an alliance against you, the tents of Edom, the Ishmaelites, Moab, the Hagarites, Gebel, Ammon, Amalek, Philistia, the people of Tyre, even Assyria has joined them. And then in Jeremiah, we've got a list of ten nations as well, who God is going to judge at the very end. And they're not the same list of names, but they inhabit the same area. Because, of course, over time, you don't call people, you know, the Ammonites when the Ammonites are not around anymore. But it's always the same area. But the place remains the same. And even Abraham was promised the land of ten nations, if we count it up in Genesis 15. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham and said, to your descendants I will give this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Rephaites, Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites. There's ten nations listed there. And this is part of the counting we have to do to figure out the best. And the promises to Abraham weren't just to Isaac. Isaac. Hagar was, you know, his other child, Ishmael, got promises as well. God said, lift the boy up and take him by the hand, for I will make him into a great nation. And in fact, he too had 12 sons. And there were promises to Esau. In Hebrews, we read, by faith Isaac blessed Esau, Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. And even Lot, who was related to Abraham, was promised certain bits of land, and the Israelites were told, don't go there, I've promised that to Lot as his inheritance. In fact, so I think the area of ten is this greater area of land from the Egypt to the Nile, which Abraham, all of his descendants were promised. But the land of seven was the bit that Israel got. And at that time, ultimately they'll get the whole lot. But at the time they went into the promised land, in Numbers 34, it's really specific. It said, command the Israelites and say, when you enter Canaan, the land that will be allotted to you as an inheritance is to have these boundaries. And it's not from the Euphrates to the Nile. Your southern side will include some of the desert of Zin along the border of Edom. Your southern boundary will start in the east from the southern end of the Dead Sea across south of the Scorpion Pass, continue on to Zin, go south of Kadesh Barnea, etc., etc. It says the boundary will go down along the Jordan and end at the Dead Sea. So that's a map. And as you can see, it's not the entire area promised to Abraham, all of his descendants at that time. So I think there's a land of seven. and this helps explain why, when we come to Revelation, it's always the same beast, this area of seven and ten. It's the land of Israel. So whenever we get a beast with seven heads and ten horns, that's what it's talking about. And when we get this red dragon with seven crowns on its head, That means it has power over this area of Israel, the land of seven, which is exactly what Herod had, which I believe this prophecy is talking about. This is the kingdom of Herod, who is this red dragon with seven heads and ten horns. He tried to kill all the, you know, threats to his kingdom, and he stood in front of the woman about to give birth so that it might devour her child the moment he was born. And that's what Herod tried to do when Jesus was born. He wanted to kill him. So literally this was talking about Herod, and that is that's why there's seven horns on the dragon, because Herod actually had that area. Then when we come to Revelation 13, a beast comes out of the sea, and it had ten horns and seven heads and ten crowns. So this is now we get to today, where we've got ten powers in the land of Israel, the days when God's going to set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. So we can see a time difference here between seven crowns and ten crowns. And the ten horns you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom but will receive 1 hour of authority as kings along with the beast. And so they have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast, which is really like Psalm 83, where they say, "Let us destroy them as a nation," which is what those ten Arab nations are plotting to do. Now, I just finish here. This is just a speculative, interesting thing that I just thought of. So, we're told, "Let the person who has insight calculate," or meaning count, "the number of the beast, for it is the number of man or humanity. That number is 666, Revelation. So the beast, we've been looking at, the beast equates to nations having power over Israel. So we're told we can count the number of the beast, but we don't know the time, this time at the end, because it hasn't happened yet. And when it does happen, it's only short for 1 hour. But I think we can count the number of the beast to this point. There were 70 years. Well, we take away the Hasmonean kingdom, which ruled for 79 years. We take away that whole gap here that doesn't, because it was out of the equation. So we had 70 years for Babylon, 207 years for the Medes and Persians, 190 years for the Greeks, then the gap of the Hasmoneans, and 199 years for Rome until 136 AD when, you know, the Jews were scattered and that desolation spread the land, and that adds up to 666. So that's something I just thought of. It's speculative and it might be wrong, but there we go. That's just... That's really where it ends. I was going to talk about Egypt, the crocodile, and it's interesting that they worshipped the crocodile god and equated him with... Pharaoh was equated with, like, the crocodile god, so kingly god.